the Veterans Radio Hour. Brought to you by Dallas Corporation for all your corporate printing needs, and by GIM Productions, creating internet solutions. Websites can do that. Now, stay tuned. The Veterans Radio Hour is next on the Veterans Radio Network.
Tango Charlie Bravo, you're a go for the Veterans Hour.
So your company has a website. We are all familiar with how the web can be used to showcase information. But did you know the web can also be used as a medium to actually do something to help your business? GIM Productions delivers custom web-based technology and applications to meet the needs of your company. We have the experience and the expertise to deliver web applications, e-commerce solutions, and interactive multimedia. GIM Productions can help you in making difficult technology decisions. We work to make web technology work for your company, and we will be there along the way to support you as you grow. Our comprehensive team includes talented programmers, software developers, graphic designers, and network specialists that strive to bring you the best. Contact us at our toll-free number 1-887-256-6914 or email us at info@gimproductions.com. Websites can do that.
Welcome, one and all, to the Veterans Radio Hour. It's our tribute to all of those who served our great nation's armed forces, past and present, and their tremendous accounts of heroic duty and bravery. With your host, Brigadier General Dave Grange. And now, coming to you live from our Veterans Center studio, here is General Dave.
And good evening. Tonight's show is not going to be with General Dave. He's on TDY. This is Kenny DeCamp. And I'm going to have a friend come in, John St. Augustine, who's going to co-host. John also is a vet like myself. He did the 80 to 84. He was an aviation survivalman, first class, with the United States Coast Guard. John is the new voice of America across the airwaves with the Power Talk Radio. We'll be bringing him on in just a minute. If you'd like to call in, please do so, 866-928-2329. Tonight's show, the greatest rescue mission ever from the Philippines. To start it out, we're going to have our special dedication for the night. And I'm going to bring in Lambert Matias, our Filipino good friend that's helped us put this whole show together. Lambert.
Thank you, Kenny. Our dedication tonight is to the American and the Filipino POWs who fought valiantly at Bataan and Corregidor, to those who suffered through the march and the camps at O'Donnell and Cabanatuan, to those that risked much and were dedicated to freeing the POWs, but especially to those who paid the ultimate price and sacrificed themselves in the name of freedom and honor. This story of valor and this dedication is much too long to recount, but much too important to forget. For our story of valor this week, we only ask that you inform yourself of this whole chapter in American and Filipino military history and honor those involved by remembering and passing along those memories for generations to come.
Here is today's military quote of the day, brought to you by support from retired Lieutenant Commander Adrian Rubenkowski.
The quote of the day is from Lieutenant Colonel Henry Mucci. He was speaking to the Army 6th Rangers, that's 121 Rangers, right before the mission to rescue at Cabanatuan. And the quote is, "You had better get down on your knees and pray. Damn it, don't fake it. I mean pray. And I want you to swear an oath before God. Swear that you'll die fighting rather than let any harm come to those POWs."
You're listening to the Veterans Hour with retired Brigadier General Dave Grange. And now, back to the broadcast.
Once again, it's Kenny DeCamp sitting in for General Dave tonight, and we're going to have quite a show dealing with the Philippines, World War II, the Death March of Bataan that ended up in a very strange and sad camp, Cabanatuan, in the Philippines. And with us tonight, I actually have some survivors from Cabanatuan. Out in the audience is Pedro Molina. He was a survivor from there. And sitting at the table with us is going to be Jose Wachan, also a survivor of the death march, someone who was able to escape. Greg Matias is in our audience, too. Hopefully we'll get him up to the microphone a little bit later. He grew up around Cabanatuan as a teenager, seeing a lot of what was happening and trying to understand a little bit more as he could. And then also at the desk with me tonight is going to be Jerry Clarito, the executive director of the Illinois Veterans Equity Center. It's a group that's organized to honor the valuable contributions that the Filipino Americans were able to do with us during this troubled time, beginning in 1941 and on its way until the end of the war in 1945. We're going to start out tonight with a very special couple guests right now. We're waiting for a couple more to call in as well. But on the phone with us is Forrest Bryant Johnson. It's a name that only certain people know, and a lot of those that do know it are very impressed because of the book that he wrote many years ago. 1978, I believe, was the first publishing, The Hour of Redemption. And he was a retired Army captain. It's a major source for the best-selling book, Ghost Soldiers, because it was actually the gripping narrative chronicle of the U.S. Army Rangers that led the raid on Cabanatuan at the POW camp in World War II. Forrest Johnson, you're there with us tonight.
Yes, it's an honor to be with you tonight.
Well, we thank you so much. I know that you had a lot to do with helping out a friend who we're waiting to call in right now, Hampton Sides, on a book called The Ghost Soldier. And could you tell us a little bit more, though, what it really meant to have the inspiration to write your book, Hour of Redemption?
Well, I became quite emotionally involved in this story, starting back at the time I lived in Melrose Park and got to know some of the fellows in Maywood who were survivors of Cabanatuan and a number of other camps from the old tank battalion. And that probably got me started in doing deep research into the story.
Mm-hmm.
Studying it to some degree for many, many years. But that was the time that I really got involved in it. And,
well,
from then, it went on to many other things.
And I see here some of our Filipino friends have already raised their eyebrows when you mentioned Melrose Park and Maywood. So you had probably had a good interaction with quite a few of the Filipinos from there that lived in this area.
Well, yes, I did. And enough to get me convinced that I had to get on to the Philippines and interview some of these people and walk the trails that the guerrillas had walked. And that's when I had the opportunity to meet then Captain Bohota during the war times. And then, as you know, later he came to live with me in the Chicago area, and we spent a year before he passed away researching the story. And it furnished me a tremendous amount of data.
And your direct contact with World War II, or can you tell us a little bit about your retired captain background?
Well, I was just a kid when this was going on. In 1945, I was 10 years old, and my father used to say, I'm going to point out something important to you each week and show you where it happened. And he'd post articles up on a bulletin board. And when this story came out, I believe in Life magazine and in the newspapers, though much of the information was inaccurate, it was still very dramatic, and he got to the Globe and showed me the Philippines and showed me where Luzon was. It didn't mean much to me at the time, but it certainly was a story. And he said, remember this, this is what being American is all about, helping your fellow man.
Mm-hmm. On the phone with us also, Forrest, is retired Major Richard Gordon, commander of what they call the Battling Bastards of Bataan. Are you there with us, Richard?
Yes, for sure are.
Well, thank you for calling in tonight and letting us know a little bit about what and all that you did. I have to admit, being a Vietnam veteran, I have never heard the term Battling Bastards of Bataan.
Yeah, well, that term was coined by Associated Press writer by the name of Hewitt, Frank Hewitt. Mm-hmm. And he was a strong favorite of General Wainwright. He was with him all during the Battle of Bataan, and we eventually evacuated. But while he was on Bataan, he came up with that little ditty, the Battling Bastards of Bataan, No Mama, No Papa, No Uncle Sam. That's in the days when people pronounced Bataan as Bataan. And so it rhymed with Uncle Sam. So it hung in there, and it's been sort of a battle cry down through the years.
Now, it says here you were the commander of the battle.
Yeah, we have a group of veterans of Bataan only, and their relatives, some associated guests that want to be part of it. And we formed a group known as the BVB, the Battling Brass of the Baton, about 12 years ago. And we did so because we began to see that the true history of Baton was being taken for with a proverbial ride. It just wasn't accurate in the books. And I think one book kicked it all off, and that was William Manchester's book, The American Caesar, when he had Corregidor surrendering one day and beginning the Baton Death March the next day. And, of course, that was a total impossibility. And that sort of started it all, and we began to realize there were people out there who wanted to know the true facts, not some of the myths and some of the outrageous stories that we're reading and have read down through the years. And so we began to organize people, especially the families of those Baton veterans. We're on the Internet. We have a website. And we, to this day, are receiving requests from families who say, my grandfather was so-and-so. Can you tell me what happened to him? And in many cases, we can tell the relatives more information than Uncle Sam ever gave them. And we're glad to do that. So it provides a bit of closure for those people as well. To say nothing more than that, we kept very busy doing that, but we also go to the Philippines periodically, and 2 years ago he built and dedicated a memorial to those Americans who died in Camp O'Donnell. 1,608 young kids died in Camp O'Donnell in about 45 days, the first 45 days we were there. And when I went back in 1999, the place had no sign whatsoever of the American ever being there. So with the permission of the Philippine government, we set about building a memorial. And anyone who visits the Philippines today and goes to Capas National Shrine, which is in Taloc, or outside of Taloc, you'll see that memorial that we put up, which we're very proud of. We maintain it. We ask nothing from Uncle Sam as far as supporting it goes. We built it with our money, and we support it with our money.
Major, this is John St. Augustine. Glad to have you with us this evening. As you were speaking, I was thinking about a couple of questions, and one of them, obviously, outside the work you do with your website, helping veterans and the families rediscover what happened there. Why is this so important that the story is told through these books? What is it we should be learning that we haven't learned yet?
Well, for instance, the story I told just a little while ago about William Manchester, he is a very noted researcher, recognized as such, and certainly a noted historian. Now, if he can write in his book what he wrote, people who read that book and looking for the history of Baton and Corregidor are not being given the proper information. And we have found mistakes in the numbers of men who were involved in the defense of the Philippines, the number of Japanese were involved in the taking of the Philippines. There has been distortions of history for a number of years concerning Baton.
And can you tell us what that website is so that our listeners could be plugged in?
It's a very lengthy, okay. But if you went to a search vehicle such as Yahoo or Google and type in the Battling Brass of the Baton, you'll be taken right into that website.
Perfect.
Good thing.
That's perfect. Now, I don't know if you were able, either yourself or Forrest was able to ever meet Jose Huachan that's here with us tonight.
No, I can't say that I did.
What about you, Forrest? Have you ever met Jose?
I don't recall. Perhaps some years ago.
Okay. Jose is with us, and you're one of the survivors. Tell us what happened with you back in the Philippines in 1941, Jose.
I was in the service of the Philippine Commonwealth. That was December 1941 up to 1946. Now, I was the first sergeant of the machine gun company, 3rd Battalion, 1st Infantry, 1st Regular Division. We call the 1st Regular Division, that is 1st Commonwealth Army in the Philippines. Originally, that is the Bolo Division. And I surrendered to the Japanese 1942, April 9.
And where did they held you at then?
We were held in Mount Saimat, where we were all concentrated. We were told to throw all our guns in a big pit, which was dug by a bulldozer. And each, every one of my men, being the first sergeant, I was leading them and to throw them all our firearms in the big pit. As soon as we passed through there, they just covered that with gravel so that nobody could see it. And then we were brought concentrated way back at Limay, where we are all concentrated to start the death march going to Camp O'Donnell. Before that, I know already because my company commander told me, I asked him, "Sir, where are we be going to?" He said, "We will all be going to prisoner of war in Camp O'Donnell or Kapas." In that time, I was already sick with malaria, and I was sick with dysentery because during these 3 months we were in Mataan, we were only running short of food and we have only one meal a day. I even have to subsidize myself eating those lizards for us to survive. So on our way from Limay, we are supposed to pass, but before I forget, that place there is where I was born. I was from Nueva Ecija. And I know definitely the area where I will be able to escape. So during our trip from the death march to going to Pampanga, I know already definitely because when I was a kid, I have been traveling with that there with my parents. We are going around that place. So that particular place is very, very familiar to me. And I know where the right place for me to escape. So I rallied my boys, being the first sergeant. The platoon headquarters was with me, and they rallied with me. My runner said, "Hey, Sarge, where are we going?" "We'll be going to the concentration camp." "Oh, I will go with you. I will go with you." And then that rumor was scattered to the whole platoon. And all of them says, "Sarge, wherever you go, we will be with you." So every night, we stop from the different places every night. I assemble my men and plan the escape. When we arrive at a certain place, then that's the time where we disperse up. But I could see those soldiers being shot by the Japanese. I could even see, I was crying crossing the street, I saw the Japanese fire at one guy who could not even step over the fence because there was barbed wire. And the place where I was able to get through was under a creek where there is no water, and run to the sugar plantation. And from then, I could see the firing, and I could see the street where so many of my friends were alive. When we reached a place, when we got there, I told them, within 3 days, we will get together on a place where the civilians were hiding. We only, out of 32 of us, only 12 survived. That includes me.
Yeah, that's an amazing story, Jose.
Yes. I'm really...
Emotional, you can see, yes.
You could see my voice, and I'm shaking. When I always think of that, I always cry. I was able to save my own life.
Fantastic, Jose. It's very meaningful, and I'm sure those boys still remember you and are loving you. I should let people know, too, that during the Bataan Death March, there was estimated 76,000 soldiers that were on that march. It was a 55-mile, no food, no water.
No water.
Tens of thousands died on this 55 miles, and by the time they reached Camp Cabanatuan, which I heard was one of the largest POW camps in all of history, that 56,000, so some 20,000 now were gone, made it to the camp. And they were imprisoned there for 3 years, and by the time they were rescued by the 6th Ranger Battalion, Forrest, you probably know a little bit about how many were still with us during that rescue?
Well, let me back up just a moment.
Sure.
That first camp was O'Donnell, and then later, after the Filipinos were released, the Americans were scattered out through the islands, but quite a few were sent over to Cabanatuan, or the Cabanatuan area. There were three camps in the Cabanatuan area originally, but the largest one is right next to the barrio of Pangatan, and the ones that remained there were
Pangatian.
Yes,
Pangatian.
Pangatian.
I know that place there because that's where I grew up.
That was your hometown?
Yes, sir. That was where I grew up. That's where I get my education. I was with the guerrilla with Pajota, Juan Pajota and Governor Hosson. He was my captain.
Yes.
And my rank in the guerrilla was already a captain, but I'm using my first sergeant stripe. I was involved in that when they were in Pangatian. There were so many, 5,000 Japanese in Bungabong, and in Kabanatuan there are about 2,000. I was assigned on the road going to Pangatian, which is in Kabanatuan itself, a few miles away. The other line, which is Pajota, under Pajota, he has about 120 troops. They were protecting Bungabong because there are 2,000 Japanese people, soldiers there ready to raid. So I myself was with Captain Hosson, who is the governor of Nueva Ecija, who died already. I was with him. Our headquarters at that time was luckily, because I was from that place, I own a little property there, which is Labong. That is our headquarters. That's where we pray. We met together how to conduct the raid. And I was really very, very familiar to that area.
Forrest, you were saying that there were three camps then.
Originally three camps. By the time that the raid took place, there was only one camp remaining. And the concentration of Allied personnel at that camp was approximately 500 to 520.
Uh-huh.
By 1945. Many had been sent out in late 44 by ship, cargo ships, to mainland Japan and to Formosa to work as slave labor. And, of course, you know the story about how many of those did not make it. The ships were sunk. They were unmarked ships. But anyway, those that were left were the numbers of about 500.
Well, good.
512. It was in the book of this author. I have the book of that, who was one of the survivors which we rescued. And I happened to meet him September of here in San Francisco.
Very good. We're going to be taking a break in a little while. This is our 25th program. We want to thank you all. I want you to know about the 1350foundation.org. The March 4th, they're having a Chicago Union League Club invitation for all of you to visit a more perfect union, a program honoring the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. Also, don't forget military.com, saluting all those who answered the call to our nation's services. Next week's program, we're going to have a very special show with some more authors. We're finding that talking to some people who have written some great books makes a lot of sense for us to understand the history. And we're also going to try to find some authors who can tell stories that are a little bit more and above. Next week's show is with Jeff Circle. He wrote the book, Yes, Drill Sergeant. And also we'll have on James Amos, who recently wrote The Memorial, that unique book on Vietnam. And James Blinn, who wrote The Aardvark is Ready for War. It's a novel that was set in the Gulf War. So come back. We'll be back with you right after this commercial.
At ease, soldier. The Veterans Hour with General Dave will settle in again after a short break on the Talk Radio Network.
Yes, we are taking a network breakaway break, and I'd like to welcome once again all of our guests online who are listening to our live simulcast on the internet. I'd also like to welcome all of our in-studio guests here. We've got a great contingent of our live studio audience out here tonight. And I'd like to remind everybody, if you are in the Chicagoland area any given Sunday night, you are more than welcome to attend our live audience here for the Veterans Radio Hour. We typically have a little reception get-together before our broadcast every week where we can meet our in-studio guests and have some refreshments and hors d'oeuvres, things like that. So if you're in the Chicagoland area, if you happen to be passing through on a Sunday night, please stop in and be more than welcome to partake in our live studio audience. Again, we've got a great show tonight. We're just taking a network break. It's the greatest rescue mission ever. The Philippines is our show tonight with guests Forrest Brian Johnson, the author, Major Richard Gordon, who is the commander of the Battling Bastards of Bataan, and Jerry Clarito, Jose. We've also got Greg Matias here with us, and also our, of course, our live entertainers. Is that we're coming back in? Is that what you're telling me? Oh, okay. All right. Well, stay tuned. We've got more great radio coming up for you, so stay with us, please.
Hour now returns to duty on the Talk Radio Network. The Veterans Hour proudly presents our military hero's story of valor.
And welcome back. This is Kenny DeCamp sitting in for General Dave. We're talking today about the greatest rescue mission ever in the Philippines. Here's a quick brief summary with my friend Tom Rendell.
Yeah, just to set the stage, it's important to understand why the Philippines were important to the overall campaign in the Pacific. The United States and the Philippine government had been in partnership for some time as far as working together for security. General MacArthur, who had been the chief of staff of the Army, had retired and had gone to the Philippines. He'd served there many times, but had started there as a young lieutenant. And on the morning of Pearl Harbor, was commanding of the U.S. forces there, having come out of retirement. And since the aircraft and other things of the Air Force were caught on the ground, he was left with very little to defend. So, unfortunately, with no Air Force and very little Navy, all that was left was ground forces. And when the Japanese invaded a few weeks after Pearl Harbor, things went very badly. But it still lay right in the middle of the shipping lanes. And so the big plan had Admiral Nimitz taking one direction and General MacArthur returning in another direction.
The Veterans Radio Hour salutes the active service person of the week, made possible through the support of Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer. As they say, PB Army, ASAP. Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer, available at your local retail outlet.
And our active duty person is Army PFC Edeline Eskew, C Company, 122 SIGBN, the unit 5088. She's a microwave communication operations specialist. She's stationed in Korea. She is a Filipino-American, and her family lives right here in the western suburbs of Chicago. We're now going to salute that active duty Army PFC, Adeline Askew.
You're tuned to the Veterans Radio Hour with retired General Dave Grange, coming to you from the Veterans Center studio. And now, back to the show.
And we're now going to have John St. Augustine tonight read for us our military story of valor.
Proud to do that as well. Thanks for having me down here. Private First Class U.S. Army Company A, 127th Infantry, 32nd Infantry Division, David M. Gonzalez. This is from 8 December 1945. He was pinned down with his company as enemy fire swept the area, making any movement extremely hazardous. A 500-pound bomb smashed into the company's perimeter, burying five men with his explosion. Private First Class Gonzalez, without hesitation, seized an entrenching tool and under a hail of fire, crawled 15 yards to his entombed comrades, where his commanding officer, who had rushed forward, was beginning to dig the men out. Nearing his goal, he saw the officer struck and instantly killed by machine gun fire. Undismayed, he set to work swiftly and surely with his hands and the entrenching tool, while enemy sniper and machine gun bullets struck all about him. He succeeded in digging one of the men out from the pile of rock and sand, and to dig faster, he stood up regardless of the greater danger, so exposing himself. He extricated a second man, and then a third. And as he completed the liberation of the third man, he was hit and mortally wounded. But the comrades for whom he so gallantly gave his life were safely evacuated. Private First Class Gonzalez's valiant and intrepid conduct exemplifies the highest tradition of the military service. Private Gonzalez was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor.
And thank you very much. Another great man gave his life at the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
Forrest Brian Johnson's with us on the phone, the author of the book Hour of Redemption, the classic novel that helped to write the book, the best-selling Ghost Soldiers. Also with us, Major Richard M. Gordon, the commander of the Battling Bastards of Bataan. Sitting at the table here with us, I want to bring in for a moment Jerry Clarito, the executive director of the Illinois Veterans Equity Center. I think, John, you had a question for Jerry to find out a few things.
Jerry, what's the currently going on with the veterans from that in the Filipinos area, and what is it that you provide for them, and how's it going these days?
It goes back to the Rescission Act of 1946. Wherein the Filipinos' services in the military service were deemed not active service for purposes of getting the benefits from the Veterans Affairs. So from that time on, there are about now 45,000 living Filipino veterans of the Second World War. So we look at it that their services were deemed not an active service. So basically, their services of the Second World War, just like what we were saying here before, the importance of the contributions of the Filipino soldiers during that time, the timetable of the Japanese was delayed for 3 months. And basically, they held at least 100,000 Japanese soldiers inside the Philippines, which could have been used in other areas. So we're looking at this as an injustice to the services of the Filipinos. So there is now a bill in Congress. It's called H.R. 677, which is called the Filipino Veterans Equity Bill of 2003. And we've been doing this all along for a decade now. It's been recycled, and it looks like in 1997, we were able to get at least 209 co-sponsors of that same bill. However, it was just reintroduced last February 11 of 2003, and we got at least 25 co-sponsors immediately, and four coming from the members of Illinois members of Congress, John Sakowski, Danny Davis, Luis Gutierrez, and Lane Evans. So this is what we are asking, actually. We are appealing to all soldiers who fought in any war to consider the Blood Brothers by asking their members of Congress to sponsor H.R. 677, which is the Filipino Veterans Equity Bill of 2003.
Can you give me a little history on how it came to be that the Filipinos started to fight with the Americans? How did that happen?
Well, the Philippines is considered a colony at that time. So in 1901, the Philippines was actually taken from Spain. So from that time on, the program of the U.S. was to educate the Philippines and teach us how to govern ourselves. So in 1935, there was this Tidings MacDafilo saying, in 10 years, you'll get your independence.
Right.
So by the time I think General MacArthur came over and saying, okay, we'll establish also, we're going to set up their military defense. But I think this came to the Orange Plan, wherein that would be the second approach that they're going to do if war will break in the Pacific. But still, it's considered that it's something like, don't worry about Japan, they're not going to attack us, right?
Right.
So in 1938, the war started, and then it goes into the war in Europe.
Yes.
Right? So, but hurriedly in July of 1941, feeling that there would be war in the Pacific, they said, okay, let's recruit about 300 able-bodied young Filipinos. That was July 1941. And the war broke December of 1941. So they were only trained for 6 months.
And only 300.
And only 300.
We were in good hands.
We were in good hands.
Exactly. Major Gordon, you're still with us there.
Yeah.
You said that you have returned back since 1999?
I've made a number of trips back to the Philippines, yes.
And have there been many others as well, do you know?
Yes. Last April, 86 of us went back to the 60th anniversary of the fall of Bataan.
Joining us at the table right now, too, is Greg Matias. He grew up in Cabanatuan. He was a teenager living there, and he has lots of personal recollections of soldiers and POWs, the camp, the raid, etc. Have you also been back? Have you returned at all?
I returned in 2001 March, and on that occasion, I went to Bataan to visit the Mount Samat Memorial that they have erected where the surrender took place.
And when you were there as a teenager, were you under the control also of the Japanese, or
yes,
were you hiding out?
Oh, yeah, our town was under control. When they came in, the Japanese came in, we had to evacuate to the rice fields, maybe about 20 miles inland from the main road. And then after they settled down, 2 or 3 months later, we went back to town and started making living, because in those days, my father was a civil servant, but he did not want to go back to the service of the Japanese government. So he had to do like driving a horse-drawn vehicle to earn money. And my mom set up a stall in the marketplace and would sell anything, buy and sell. And I helped her doing that. And it is on that experience that I saw the soldiers, the American prisoner of war. Maybe most of them were Navy, I think, from the uniforms that I recall that they were wearing. They would come to town maybe once a week, walking beside the carabao, which is the it's a work animal, pulling a cart, but they would not be allowed to ride the cart nor the carabao. They would have to walk on gravel road from Pangatian to downtown, which probably, when I was young, I thought it was like 30 miles away, but probably now it's probably like 5-6 miles away. And they were going back and forth, walking on gravel roads to get provisions from the city, from the town, to bring back to camp.
Mm-hmm. Jose, what about you? Have you returned there as well?
Yes, sir. I was, when I was a prisoner of war, I was able to escape. In the end, I went home. When I went home, my house, my mother thought that I was a ghost, because they know that when Murphy was bombed, it was put in the papers, the whole occupants of M Company, which is the last building, which was directly hit. And on top of that, I was supposed to graduate at that time. My company commander said, okay, turn in your personal belongings because you will be graduating and we will send it out. So when I arrived in the Philippines, I was able to escape. My mother thought I was already dead. And that was 3 months. There was already several, a memory for him. So she fell down and he thought that I was a ghost. But my brother saw me, and he said that my cousin, oh, that's Joey. I thought he died. And then my mother, who is the, you know, when the soldiers there, the Filipinos, the Japanese are trying to gather all those who escaped. And my mother told me to surrender to the Japanese. And I told her, no, ma'am, I have a sworn statement to the United States government. I will never surrender to the Japanese. So I ran up on the hills. That's where I joined the guerrillas.
Good for you there, Jose.
I was involved on the rescue of this 512 prisoners of war in Cabanatuan City.
Uh-huh.
With
all right.
Governor.
Forrest, when we come back, we're going to want you to talk a little bit about how the Rangers got involved with the Filipinos for this final raid. We're going to be taking a quick break in just a few minutes. Once again, we were hoping that Hampton Sides was going to call in with us and possibly will be. And as our show goes on, we'll be leaving the airwaves somewhere around 9:59, but then we'll stay on for another 20 minutes with our website, veteransradiohour.com.
You're listening to the Veterans Hour on the Talk Radio Network.
And we are once again at another network break, and I'd like to thank everybody online listening to our live simulcast for hanging in there. We did have some internet chat questions coming in, and I'd like to encourage everybody online to go ahead and write up some questions and send them in, and we'll get to those questions as soon as we can. We have a lot more talking to do with our guests here tonight, but we will get to some of our chat questions, and after we sign off on the airwaves and continue our live broadcast on the internet, I'm sure we'll get to more of those live chat questions. Thank you once again for checking in, and we'd like to remind everybody to pass the word about the Veterans Radio Hour, and we have some great guests tonight. We also have some great topics to cover. Kenny DeCamp had talked about the show next week, and we're going to summarize that next show in a little bit. But in the meantime, please stay with us. We've got a lot more show coming up for you about the Philippines and the greatest rescue mission ever.
The Veterans Hour now returns to full readiness on the TRN Talk Radio Network.
And we're back live. General Dave's not in today. This is Kenny DeCamp sitting in for him. We're talking about the greatest rescue mission ever in the Philippines, from the battle, the Death March of Bataan, all the way to the raid that took place to secure the POWs from Kapanatuan. And right now I want to bring on Forrest Johnson, if you can come back on with us for a minute. And tell us a little bit about how the Rangers and the Filipinos worked together on this raid.
Well, they were merged together as the intelligence section of the 6th Army brought in Colonel Moosey and the Rangers. And they were told by Bob Lappin, Major Lappin, who was an American guerrilla fighting in that area, Captain Hosan and Captain Pahota both answered to Major Lappin. Lappin would remain back at headquarters, but the Ranger group, which was a C company and part of F company, would be going cross-country through Nueva Ecija and be heading towards the Kapanatuan area. They would be assisted first by Hosan and his men, because they were the ones that had occupied that area with the guerrilla activity, and then would be joining later with Pahota, whose section under Lappin was in the Kapanatuan area. So this was the beginning of the merger, and as I say, they first they crossed a country, all this behind enemy lines, of course, on foot, before the days of helicopters, and led by Hosan and his men, who formed the perimeter of defense when they took a break, and then they met up with Pahota.
Uh-huh. And that raid lasted about how long?
You mean the actual raid itself?
The actual raid itself.
Probably not much longer than about 35 minutes.
Really?
It's called practically an hour. And most of the decisive things happened in the first 10 to 15 minutes. The evacuation of the rest of the POWs took a little bit longer. And, in fact, one, as you may have heard, was left behind accidentally. But in any event, we're talking about something that all occurred in about 30 to 40 minutes.
Well, how long was the approach, the march itself?
Well, that was, let's see, how many hours going across that time? A day and a half. They covered some 30 miles on foot, as I said. And then when they arrived in the area, Pahota and his scouts informed the Rangers that it would be suicidal to attempt to attack the camp that night. They would have to wait. They had planned to go ahead and attack that night. They sent a radio message back saying that the mission would be delayed 24 hours. The reason was there was a tremendous amount of troop movement going along the main highway from Kapanatuan City north past the camp, and a Japanese battalion had bivouacked at the Kabu Bridge area just north of the camp. So if they had tried to attack that night, they would have certainly been wiped out, and so would have their prisoners. So based on Pahota's information, they delayed the attack until the next evening.
And what about Filipino civilian participation, any kind of transportation?
Yes, a tremendous amount of help from the civilians. Some were nurses and doctors, such as Dr. Layug, were on duty immediately. Well, Layug was part of Pahota's army anyway. He was a sworn member of the American Army. But in any event, the civilians were recruited and volunteered to first help, of course, feed the Rangers. And it was the old-fashioned Filipino fiesta, so to speak, in a modified version. The Rangers were treated very, very well. And the perimeter defense that was formed around, say, Platero and Balancari as they moved around there was set up by Pahota and Hosan's men. But the civilians were the backup personnel, and it was kind of hard to tell. The Rangers were hard to tell how many were actually guerrillas and how many were not. There's so many people involved. But what Colonel Musi needed more than anything was a way to evacuate the prisoners once the raid was accomplished and the mission was accomplished. And Pahota came up with the idea of the carabao carts. And then, of course, they had to go through the whole area recruiting the carts, get them ready. And there again, the civilians were the ones that provided these carts, sacrificed and endangered their own lives to do so.
Would you think such a raid could be done today with this kind of... I mean, can we...
I don't think so.
Can we go into Iraq and...
No, first of all, it could only... A mission like that can only be accomplished in an area or a country where you have the support of the vast majority of personnel. You'd have to have that. And secondly, with today's technology, troop movements across even 100 or 200 men going cross country could easily be detected. There's a lot of ways they would do it today, of course, by helicopter, airborne assault, and you're going to be taking on much larger casualties in number than they did. But no, it couldn't be done. I can't think of anywhere where we could have had that much support going in as we did in the Philippines.
Exactly. Well, we're going to be taking, again, our little bit of a break, and once we're off the airwaves, we're going to then be able to move a little bit more towards on streaming just on the web, no commercials, and we'll be able to get a little bit more into depth. If you could stick with us for us, we'd really appreciate it. And to go out, something from the 40s. Here's our friend Mark DeMin, and we'll be back after these commercials.
A little Glenn Miller for your pleasure.
When I hear that serenade in blue, I'm somewhere in another world alone with you, sharing all the joys we used to know many moons ago. Once again your face comes back to me, just like the theme of some forgotten melody in the album of my memory. Serenade in It seems like only yesterday, the small cafe across...
And you've been listening to the Veterans Radio Hour. Join us next week again for another edition of the Veterans Radio Hour, live from the Veterans Center Studios. Good night.
So, tell me, darling, is there still a spark? Or only lonely ashes of the flames we knew? Should I go on whistling in the dark? Serenade.
I'm sorry.
In blue.
Yeah, there we are. Just a little bit too much comedy. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Kenny.
We like to end some of our shows with a little bit of sound, music-wise. All the intensity that takes place on the Veterans Hour, all the things that we learn and all the things that we go through. And some of the stories tonight, just totally unique. We had hoped to have had Hampton Sides with us, the author of Ghost Soldiers, but something complicated must have come up. We want to thank Major Richard Gordon for being along with us, the commander of the Battling Bastards of Bataan. And Jerry Clarito is still going to be sitting with us here at the table, along with Jose Washan, some people helping out with the Philippine-American way of life that we need to balance. As well as Lambert Matias is here with us. Lambert works with the Veterans Radio Hour, and he was the one who came up with why we should be doing a show like this. And I see on the phone, too, Jay Greeley is called in now, so we'll be opening it up a little bit more. Lambert, why don't you talk for a few minutes?
You know, Kenny, I'm a very proud Filipino-American. I'm first-generation American-born. Born in Baltimore, Maryland, 1965, and I have a personal interest in this whole subject matter because my entire family on my dad's side is from Cabanatuan. My Uncle Greg was up here talking about some of the things that he remembered, growing up as a teen in Cabanatuan. But I wanted to ask Forrest a question. Forrest, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good to have you with us, Forrest. I wanted to ask you, how long did it take you to research the information for your book?
Originally, it took about 6 years. Now, we're going back before the days of laptops and PCs, so most of it had to be done by hand. That is, phone calls, letters, telegrams, and personal visits and personal interviews. So that was one of the reasons, and probably it's a good thing that it required so much time, because information is still coming out that I didn't even have back then. As I mentioned to you, when the first book was published in 78, I continued to research the story or gathering any bits of information that would come along and started revising the book. And then when Time Warner picked it up last year and re-released it this past September, I had those revisions incorporated. I felt a lot better about it. There had been a few changes and a few names I needed to add, but so we took all that time, I'd say a lot longer than 6 years.
And what are you now doing? Are you still writing at all, Forrest?
I'm working on novels right now. I've got a nostalgia novel that I've been working on. This is complete now, and I'm searching, playing around with two other nonfiction stories that I'm thinking about getting into. And I also run a desert tour business out here in Las Vegas.
A desert tour business?
You take people out to the desert in Hummers. And bring them back, by the way.
Yeah.
And what kind of vehicles do you use to take
We use Hummers.
Of course.
Each one.
Yeah, right.
Of course, you
the
would.
Real thing.
We've got a call on the line. Jay Greeley, are you there with us?
Sure.
Yeah, you got a question coming in?
Well, I think the biggest question is what was the morale of the troops when MacArthur left and then left, is it General Wainwright? Or I'm trying to think of the general's name that it was left there.
What about Jose?
In charge of the Philippines. What was the morale of the soldiers? Did they think he was coming back or, you know, the prisoners?
Yeah, Jose, would you know anything about how did you feel yourself about General MacArthur and whether or not you thought he was coming back to the Philippines? And
well, we know definitely that MacArthur, before he left, he said, "I shall return." That we have that always in our mind. That's why we stayed in the mountains for so many years, in the Cordillera Mountains, without any food. But MacArthur is giving us supplies through the eastern part, through submarines, which is being landed across the Cordillera Mountains, which where we are hiding there. Since 1945, which was the liberation of these 512 prisoners of war in Cabanatuan City, which was September 30th of 1945. So we have been in the mountains for almost three, four years, waiting for MacArthur.
Wow.
And that's the first thing that we did during the landing of MacArthur in Langayen. Our job there, the guerrilla, was to assign each and every guerrilla unit in the road, the Manila North Road, they were assigned in the bridges, just in case the Japanese, I mean MacArthur, will go to proceed to Manila to rescue the prisoners of war at University of Santo Tomas, where the civilian Americans are being held. So when MacArthur came in here, when the Japanese went to Manila, our job there is to blow out all the bridge, but they did not. The Japanese did not. They hold it, so the bridges there were not blown up. That was our duty as a guerrilla, to hamper or to prevent them to going to Manila, and because we got the news that the first thing that the Japanese will do is to kill every POWs. In Palawan, everybody was dead there. In Leyte, there were a small one there, but there were only few survived. In Los Baños, Laguna, there is also prisoners of war, but there are only very few there, not so much. But the most is in Palawan, nobody survived. And in Leyte.
Can I tell you, it's just fantastic what you're telling me. What's so interesting is that my doctor, when I was a kid growing up in Green Bay, was a survivor of the Bataan Death
yes.
March. And my dad used to just tell me what those guys went through and had the utmost respect for him. And here he was the same age as my dad at the time, and he looked, instead of looking like 40-ish, he looked like he was in his 60s. I mean, he just, he even gave my wife and I our physical just before we got married 23 years ago. So I just think about his courage. You know, here I played football, and he was the doctor of the team and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I think back on it, and, this guy, carried on and actually raised a family, did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think about, and now he would have been somebody that would have been, we would have never had his talent or his presence
mm-hmm.
if, you guys didn't do your job. It's a grateful nation.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You know, this is it's a really key show for us because we have a chance to talk to people like yourselves who've been around for quite a while, leading the way and showing us what we're needing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to thank you for that. But you also know that there are quite a few people that participated in operations in the Philippines who became very important to the American Army. Bull Simons, for instance, one of our big Special Forces fellows that led the Sante prison raid. A mm-hmm. book has recently been released by a sergeant major retired named Galen Kittleson, who's also a member of the Rangers who participated in the raid. Donald Blackburn, a lieutenant general retired, was also one of the planning directors of the Sante prison raid, also to rescue prisoners in the Vietnam War in 1970. But one of the key participants and one of the survivors was the Chief of Staff, Harold K. Johnson, who at the opening of the Vietnam War, of course, having been a POW and identifying as he did with the Army and with soldiers and their suffering, couldn't bear to say no to the President or resign because, as it's been pointed out in several books recently, he had to take care of his men, and he learned that as a POW. So in many ways, this guy stuck around and served valiantly as the Chief of Staff, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and began to help tone things down a bit, part of that because of his contact with folks like yourselves.
Absolutely. And I'm really honored to be sitting at the table with these guys, just like Jose here, too. I have another question for Forrest. Forrest, are you still there?
Excuse me?
Forrest, that is Lambert again.
Yes.
I have another question for you. First of all, I want to give you a quick plug on your book, Hour of Redemption. I picked it up from Borders, so I encourage anybody to go out there and pick up a copy of Forrest's book. It's great. Forrest, in the back of your book, you've got a roster.
Yes.
A roster of all the six Rangers as well as some of the all the other military people involved. Is this all-encompassing? Is there anybody that's not listed here that you know of?
There's a lot of people not listed there. I don't have any speakers on, guys. Anyway, the roster of the Filipinos was derived from two sources. One was from our own archives, and that is the soldiers that were Filipino soldiers, which, of course, American Army, received the Bronze Star for participation in this activity. Pahota had his list, which corresponded with it quite accurately. But Pahota also had with him, when he was visiting with me that year, a list of other squadrons that were unrecognized. And part of his mission, he felt, coming to America, and this goes back to 76 now, 77, part of his mission was to seek recognition for these squadrons have been overlooked. Now, of course, there were squadrons throughout the Philippines and many islands that were never recognized by our government, and that's quite a subject for debate there as to how this happened, and I offer a few ideas on it at the end of my book. But that's where that list came from. So to my knowledge, and I appreciate the plug, my book is the only one that's ever been printed in the United States that lists the Filipino participants, or at least some of them that were recognized.
Yeah, I was just I'm very impressed with that. And another quick question for you, Forrest. Do you know of the raiders, what was it, a couple hundred raiders that took part in the rescue? How many?
121.
How many survived?
The raid?
The raid, yeah.
Well, we lost two men. when Sweezy was killed, there's still a little bit of debate on that. He was killed in a crossfire. It's felt our own guys shot him as they were evacuating the area. Sweezy was one. He was killed by rifle fire. And then the surgeon, Captain Fisher, was in the main road in front of the camp, and he was killed by shell fragments. Actually, he died later on a car, but he was hit in the abdomen by shell fragments, and they took him back to Platero. Dr. Layug and Musselman, Dr. Ott, a number of the POWs that had just been released, including Dr. Layug, who was working in that area, worked on him, but they were unable to save him. So we lost two. We had a number of wounded. Some of the Alamo scouts were wounded with the same shell fragments. A couple of them were nicked by bullets, but that was the only one. So Pahota lost no one in his battle, by the way.
Wow.
Jerry, I want to get back to you for just a second, if we can. You probably can sum up a little bit of what we probably all need to know, you know, being the advocate that you are as the executive director of the Illinois Veterans Equity Center, which is primarily working towards some sort of reality, I would imagine, of what the Filipino-American World War II veteran is all about. Summarize for us a little bit so we have just a little bit more knowledge.
Yes, we have this national network for veterans equity, and this group is composed of sons and daughters of the Filipino veterans of World War II, advocates, and the veterans themselves. What we are realizing right now is the veterans are now in their late 70s and maybe late 80s, and they're still looking for the recognition of their military service during the Second World War. And this is translated into the health and pension benefits of the Filipino veterans that they are not receiving, that their blood brothers are receiving. And we have mentioned earlier the contributions of the Filipino veterans in protecting freedom and democracy that we are actually enjoying now. And this is what they are actually crying for. It looks like there's an injustice in not recognizing their military service, wherein they fought together, side by side with the American soldiers. And it's not their fault, because the war came to the island because the Americans were there. So they're fighting for their homeland, fighting for, actually they took oath to fight under the Constitution of the United States. And that was an executive order of July of 1941, President Roosevelt. But then in February of 1946, President Truman signed the Rescission Act, but he was saying it's still the moral obligation of the United States to take care of the Filipino World War II veterans. But that's not happening right now. We've been always lobbying for the passage of the Filipino Veterans Equity Bill. And this year, I think, this could be the last call. Most of these veterans are dying, and most of them are dying. Five veterans are dying every day. And what we have experienced here in Chicago, there are veterans who came here without any support without any support from the Veterans Administration, and the community is trying hard to also provide help for these people. There is a special segment of the Filipino community, because they fought, and I think this is their legacy to young Filipino Americans, and I think to the Americans as well, in trying to fight against invasion of the enemy at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you definitely should come back on March 9th, because we're having a show that is going to be quite unique for you to also be a part of, probably. It has to do with Veterans for Constitutional Law and the Veterans Voting Bloc. It's organizations of veterans fighting for veterans, and sons and daughters of veterans also fighting for them, trying to help us figure out more of how we can get our benefits. We've got a phone call in now from Steve out in Washington. You there?
Yes, I am, Kenny.
You got a question for us?
Oh, I just want to know if the Filipino guest there knew of George Drabo or Joseph Iavino or maybe even Les Tenney. He was on your show earlier in last year. He wrote that book, My Hitch in Hell. They were part of Company B, 192nd Tank Battalion. George Drabo was, and so was Les Tenney, and Joseph Iavino was a Marine, but they were at Cabana Tawan.
Oh, they were. Do you know this, Jose? Have you heard of these names?
I have read Les Tenney, who wrote a book also.
Right.
I have a book of him. He gave me, I met him in one time here in Cabana, in Manila, in Chicago. He gave me a book. But I do not, at that time, I will not be able to, when he relayed to me, then I said I was included. I was one of the, that rescued there in Cabana Tawan City. At that time, I was only 20 years old. So I will not, never. But I have seen the names in these books that they will have. I will not be able to know him then, because I'm still very young at that time.
Excuse me, this is Forrest Johnson.
Of course.
I heard the name George Drabo, and I wanted to say it was George that got me started on the deep research with this story many, many years ago, like in 1971. Is George still with us?
I don't believe so, but I know his son, Steve. He belonged to the American Legion Post 133 in May, what they were called Defenders of Bataan.
Yes.
And Colonel Ted Wicker took the battalion over, 192nd Tank Battalion, in July of 41.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the first scoutmaster of Troop 73 in Maywood, and he wasn't too good a shape when he got back. He was a good-looking guy when he took him over, but he looked like an old man when he got back. He was tortured and beaten, but he was a hell of a guy. And there was another kid I went to school with, Anthony Iavino, and his father, Joseph Iavino, was at Cabana Tawan. Both of them attended school in Maywood at Proviso East, and that's where I attended.
You know, I'm looking
both over, of their fathers were at Cabana Tawan.
I'm looking over some of the history of the Philippines, and I understand here it was brought up a little bit that the USA bought the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Guam all at the same time from Spain in 1898. And then they began the Filipino-American Independence War from 1898 to 1902. 4,234 Americans were killed, and over 16,000 Filipinos were killed, and 200,000 more Filipinos died from famine and pestilence. And the Philippines stayed lost in this world and was colonized until 1946.
That's right.
And I guess that's when Truman signed just
before the granting of the independence of July 1946. He signed it February of 1946. So there's the key there.
Yeah, that
now
is,
you're saying, okay, you're now responsible for your kids.
Where does that all stand now, the equity for the Filipino veterans? What's the current status of that?
The current status is it's still in the Veterans Affairs Committee. And it was sponsored by at least 25 members of Congress. The difference right now, there are more people, there are more members of Congress who are jumping in to help us because realizing that there are just maybe few veterans who would be benefiting from the passage of the bill.
Jerry, if there's anybody of us out here that would like to get involved with that or find out more information about that particular cause, how can we, where can we go to get some more information about that?
Well, my email is hr491@hotmail.com, and my number is 847-568-9338. And they can also write me at the Illinois Veterans Equity Center, 1332 West Irving Park, Chicago, Illinois, 60613.
I'd just like to also...
What was that phone number again? 847-568-9338.
Yes.
7338 and your email?
Yes, hr491@hotmail.com.
Okay. Hey, Big Steve, we'll get to your question in a minute. I mean, our question for you, the question of the week. But I wanted to just, before we lose you folks tonight, you know, it was, as was said earlier, the Spanish-American War, 1898, Philippines either bought or captured or whatever you want to call it, kind of a difficult partnership for some time, which resulted in independence, the only colony the United States ever really had. But it's interesting to me that in 1902 there was fighting, in 1903 there was fighting, and in 2003 we're back fighting on the same side against another sort of, would you say, a communist or a Muslim-based organization, Abu Sayyaf. Do either of you have anything that you want to say about the current situation? As far as what you may know about it or what you think the future may hold?
This is my opinion. I think what I would like to say here is the long-standing relationship of the Filipino people and the American people, more so on how we fought together during the Second World War. The current situation, it's a little bit complicated in a sense that the Mindanao has at least the majority of the Muslim population. So that's where the secessionist movement is strong. At the same time, the Abu Sayyaf, which is a splinter group, looks like has a connection with the terrorists. So that's a separate issue, because I think the Muslim has a real quest for secession in the Philippines, because they've never been taken care of the central government.
I want to thank everybody for being here tonight on the Veterans Radio Hour. Wished General Dave was with us tonight. He probably would have really enjoyed this and added a lot to it. Forrest Brian Johnson, I want to thank you so much for being a part of this. Everybody pick up his book, The Hours of Redemption. Also want to thank Major Richard Gordon, our commander of the Battling Bastards of Bataan. Jerry Clarito, who's been so eloquent here tonight, talking for the Filipino-American, the executive director of the Illinois Veteran Equity Center. Greg Matias for coming down and talking for a little bit, that teenage guy who was running around Cabanatuan during all this time. And Jose, you are one hell of a guy.
Amen.
You are
yes,
a good
sir.
One, buddy.
Well, I just tell what really happened. I have met this Forrest Johnson, this Gerard, Camp Gerardi. You remember me, Forrest?
I'm sorry, I must apologize, Jose. Once
I just got your letter.
Yes.
I just got your letter.
He's a good-looking guy.
Yeah.
You met in Missouri just a few months ago.
Yeah, well, I was there in their reunion of these Rangers.
I remember you well.
And Bugsby sent me a letter also asking me to write those veterans who are survived. I got their signatures, and I got those pictures we sent me. And this paper man that interviewed me, he sent me a copy of that Independence newspaper there in this couple of Missourian writers. I got all those things. Thank you very much that you still remember me.
And a great big thanks to John St. Augustine for coming in, the new voice of America, Power Talk Radio. Keep listening for him. We're glad he was here. Lambert Matias, you pulled it off. I want to thank all of Lambert's family and his girlfriend and everybody out there. I mean, really great. And once again, Mark DeMinn for singing. Another great show. Veterans Radio Hour. See you here next week. Thanks, Forrest.
Thank you, sir. Yeah.